go. All right, let's go ahead and get started. We're going to grab a seat. Well, good afternoon. Thank you for coming. My name is Sean Deacon. I'm a Dynamics CRM Premier Field Engineer with Microsoft. And we'll be talking to you guys today about migrating to CRM Online. A little bit about my background. I started with the CRM support team in Fargo, North Dakota, yes, and you betcha, with version 1.0, the CRM. So I was on the support team, 1-800-MICROSOFT. May have talked to some of you guys through support incidents over the years. And I was a support engineer on that team for about 3 years and a technical lead for a couple years before moving to the Premier Field Engineering team, working with our largest enterprise Premier customers. So we're an add-on to your Premier support agreement. So if you've got Premier support agreement, someone's talking about the DSE role, that's what Sean and I do as dedicated support engineers for our customers. So I work with four different large enterprise customers, two of them which are here today. The Caterpillar just had their session, and LDS Church is another one. They're gonna be having a session tomorrow if you're curious to see how they deployed CRM and what they're doing with their organization.
My name is Sean McNellis. We decided to keep it simple by keeping our first names the same. Apologies for different spellings in advance. I've also had a really similar career path to Sean. The only difference is I probably went more the development perf route, but same thing. We started on the support team at about the same time, be 13 years in January, and have been on the PFE team around 8 years working with our largest customers.
Excellent. All right, so this is the session. We've done this session quite a few years, this type of format on different topics, typically at Convergence. So who here has been to one of our sessions at Convergence? All right, we got some hands. Good. It's good. A little different audience here, right? So has anybody ever seen this many open seats at one of our sessions at Convergence? No, right? Yeah, exactly. So it's a lot different audience with the IT pro here versus Dynamics, where it's all Dynamics people, because then it was a lot different. So this is nice. This is a small, intimate group. We'll be able to have a great interactive discussion today as we go through. When we do, we'll go through kind of the 15 tips. We say in 15 minutes, but we can never really do that. So it'll be probably a half hour. And then we're going to open up. We want to have, you'll see, we're going to cover a lot of different areas just to kind of get you guys thinking about some of the different areas maybe you're already working on, or things that you got questions on or just wondering what others are doing. We want to use the mics as much as possible. Otherwise, we have to repeat every single question again for the folks who are streaming live and for the recording. So just to kind of kick it off then, other things, who here is not already using CRM today? They're just curious about CRM. Ken, come on. Okay, so one in the back, couple like there. All right, and how many here are on CRM on-premise today but are thinking to go to online? Okay, excellent. Good session to attend. And how many are already on CRM Online today? Quite a few. So those, keep your hands up. These are your co-presenters, right? Because we're an interactive discussion. So you guys already went through this. We want to learn from what you guys have as well. So, all right, let's go ahead and jump into, to cover the objectives already, but kind of the different tips that we've got lined up. The first tip being really reviewing the new features and functionality. And part of this, what's new in the next version? Because depending on where you're at, we could ask a bunch more questions about what version of CRM that you're on to start with. Some of you are going to be on 4.0 maybe still. Some are in 2011, 2013, 15, 16. There's all different paths that you take to get to CRM Online depending on where you're at. So part of that investigation and kind of plan has to be what versions are, or what features are we not using today that are now available, or things that we maybe built as some big customization that's now available out of the box in CRM Online in the latest version. So there's things like that you can do. The other thing you do with that is you may have to build a business case, number one, why you want to go to CRM Online, and then two, why do we want to go to the next update in CRM Online? So using that what's new information out there, and we've got some of this information. I should mention too, our blog is CRM in the Field. So if you just search for CRM in the Field, you'll see our blog. We just posted a blog article out there. I think as long as the time zones are right, it may post right after the session. But it'll be out there with all these, the information here, as well as additional links. So links and information, so you don't have to be jotting all this stuff down. Just go to CRM in the Field, and it'll be the latest blog article that's out there.
Not crminthefield.com, though. Search right. For CRM in the Field.
Yep,
it's an MSDN blog.
MSDN blog, exactly. So the ones that are out there is a what's new in CRM, and you can see from an end user standpoint, and then there's a what's new for administrators and customizers. So you can see that type of stuff. Then you also, the trick is, I'm working with a customer right now that's coming from like 2013 going to online. Well, you got to click back. There's a tab for each version. So you kind of got to aggregate all that information to get understand really what's new and what's changing. Don't just look on that one tab.
Satellite services too.
What's that?
The satellite services, not just the core product, like understanding the changes in satellite.
Correct, yeah, so the satellite services. So what are other, you know, the other products that are integrating in with CRM and that are available with the portals and MDM and MSE, and we could go on and on with that. So taking a look at all those. So.
Yep. Next up, we're gonna talk a little bit about, or I'll talk a little bit about data migration strategy. So this is a huge topic, and we've actually done at TechReady an internal training event. We spent a full hour and a half demoing one small piece of technical content around data migration. So this could literally be an all day or a week long session. However, we wanna underscore the importance, if that isn't obvious, but there are a lot of different ways you can go about migrating. So there's two different pieces. We're gonna talk about one in a minute, which is more the integration story. The data migration story is really important because you need to get the data up into the online portion of the service when you're gonna transition over. And so some things to keep in mind are obviously, what's the state of migrating? Are you gonna do a cutover? If you do a cutover, how are you gonna make sure that the data's there in enough time so that your users can be cut over and you don't have a huge dark window to put the data up? Some strategies we've employed in the past with customers, and it really depends on the state of your data and where you're at as far as maturity for the data. Sometimes there's batch processing, but a lot of times we're able to pre-stage data, get it up into the production environment beforehand, and then do nightly diffs or daily diffs or hourly diffs so that over the course of, let's say, the month or 2 weeks before go live, we have the data there. Of course, that implies that there's a little bit of gap in between when your development cycles are maturing and you're getting ready to the final product and what's in the online service. But that's one thing to look at and think about, and actually that's one way that you can insulate yourself from a lot of risk as far as go live is by, number one, properly staging the data. That can make a huge performance impact, positively, performance impact. And then if you can start getting that data up there ahead of time and do diffs, that can save you a lot of heartache. The other thing to think about is what's out there. So you can go as low level as custom.net. We have a PFE core library. It's a library that myself and another PFE have written. And the purpose of it is really to manage parallel connections to CRM Online. So you can import records at 1 per second if you want, or you can go all the way up in the best possible case scenario right now at around 2,000 records per second by managing how you use the library. So that's one way. What if you're not a coder? There's other ways. If you have SSIS, so you have database people, maybe more database developers, you can use SSIS packages. There's tools like Cozy Rock, Kingsway Soft that have destination adapters. There's also products like Scribe and Informatica that allow you to do batch integrations through those ETL tools. And there's another tool that Microsoft offers called the Data Loader Tool. And the Data Loader Tool allows you to take CSV files, large amounts of CSV file data, import it, and then we do the high throughput parallel execution of the data import as well. The next is ISV solutions. So this somewhat goes without saying, but you wanna take your ISV solutions you have in place and do some diligence around what do I need? Do the users really use this thing? And then of course the all important question is having a relationship with your ISV and your partner, whether it's more prepackaged software or it's custom, because it's really important that they're taking advantage of some of the new capabilities or not relying on things that have already been sunsetted or aren't working well. And so, again, real big focus here because the more you partner and the earlier you get ahead of this with the ISV solutions, the easier this whole process goes. And when going through and evaluating, one of the best things you can do if you're working with a partner over time is involving them in that process as well. I realize sometimes that can be a little difficult, depending on what you're actually looking at doing. But really, more partnership the better, and earlier the better. As early as you can get on this, even if it's something where you do a pre-diligence phase, you go through this as a, kind of a high-level deal, it can really save a lot of time and a lot of heartache. Next tip is with, bullet point, is really around federation and single sign-on. Who uses Office 365 here, right now, already? And then federation as well, I presume. You have on-prem identity providers. Yeah, it's really common. When we look at Office 365 customers, a lot of them use ADFS or external STSs to log in. And so if you're not already an Office 365 customer, and maybe CRM's lucky enough to have you as a customer whose first experience with Office 365 is CRM, make sure to look at the fast track, I think we're still calling it fast track, onboarding process for federation. It's really important that you follow those guidelines and you get Federation working right. I look at identity, and a lot of people do and should, as the building blocks, that core foundation. If the identity piece is wrong, it will be the gift that keeps on giving. You'll continue to have issues with it until it gets right. So it's really important if you're approaching a product and you're net new, make sure to put in time, get an identity architect or get somebody who really focuses on that, even our own onboarding teams at Microsoft. Get that right first as you're going through your project. It's not just gonna come along with the service and set itself up and be correct. So take time and prepare yourself there. Next is integrations. So I touched on data migration a little bit earlier, and sometimes you can use your data migration to do your integrations or vice versa. Like, we'll write our business logic, we'll write our integration. Then what we'll do is we'll tickle every record. That'll push it through the integration and migrate it into CRM Online. That can work. One of the downsides with that, of course, is you're putting all of your data through these business processes. So call out here is maybe look at these as two separate phases. And again, back to the data migration piece, pre-staging is key. That'll help you. And in the integration department, think of that as more of your daily operations and maybe batch jobs. The other thing with integrations is combining logic is a good idea. So if you have like a three-phase or a four-phase integration process where you go through and you touch the same records over and over again, you might want to spend some time figuring out putting your integration maybe at the end of that process so that you're not constantly shoving data through and it becomes a highly dependent thing that you're waiting extra time for. So we spend a lot of time optimizing integrations to make sure we can get things done in minutes or the low number of hours, because we don't want to bleed over. And some common areas we see, or common products we see with integrations, people use Scribe, those same ETL tools, SSIS, but there's also some new things that you should look at, like Service Bus. We had an older Service Bus integration. There's a refreshed version of the Service Bus that CRM Online 8.1 and higher uses. Take a look at that. It's pretty cool. It works really well. And we also have options with Logic Apps. If you haven't heard of Logic Apps, think of a slightly easier to use sort of BizTalk in the cloud. It's a way for you to declaratively, outside of CRM, design flows to say, hey, as a record changes in CRM, work it through this process and go send it over here, or go text message somebody, or change the data and write it back into CRM. So take a look at Logic Apps if you haven't already.
All right, other things to consider, email. So what's your email integration story? Are you using the email router on-premise and maybe forward mailbox, and how is it working, or why are you using it? There may be things that you were tied to before. Some of the stuff that we've added now with the hybrid support for server-side sync to look at. Before, that didn't work from online to on-premise, and there's, as we've progressed in the releases now, we've got that working with all the different combinations. So even if you're still with Exchange on-premise, that can connect to with CRM Online now for server-side sync. So if you're not already using server-side sync, this is a great time to consider using server-side sync and to look at that. That's really where our focus is. We continue as a Microsoft and the product team to continue to make investments in server-side sync and then build on other features. So there's, you know, the folder synchronization and different things that have been added that are, you know, dependent on server-side sync being in place and working. Whereas the email router is really meant for those folks who are not using Exchange today. So if you're still a Lotus Notes shop, for some reason, or if you're using POP3, or you have some other strange configuration, we've seen some stuff with BPOSD and things like that that don't technically work with server-side sync yet. You might have to use the email router, but try to move towards server-side sync and get that type of stuff working for you. It's a much better experience in terms of troubleshooting and monitoring and just the scalability of what you can do with server-side sync versus a single. Especially when you're going to online, it's really weird to have an on-premise CRM email router virtual machine sitting there they have to log into to manage and maintain. It just doesn't flow well. Server-side sync, I mean, it's built with, you know, CRM Online in mind and working with that that type of administration. The next is the Outlook integration. So if you're using, who here is using Outlook clients today? The CRM Outlook client installed, right? Okay, so as you've got that deployed and you have it configured to CRM on-premise, so part of that is most likely going to be an upgrade and a reconfiguration, because those clients are all configured to use, you know, HTTP, your CRM server alias name or whatever you've got with on-premise, where you're going to have to configure that to your CRM online instance now. Right? So part of it, if you're on 2015 on-premise, you're going to upgrade that to a 2016 Outlook client, apply Service Pack 1, the latest updates, and then you're going to run the reconfigure. You can do that all behind the scenes. You can use SCCM, and there's programmatically ways that you can, from a command line, you can script out and do that so your end users don't have to click through and do that, but you will have to go through a reconfiguration.
And if you are migrating, one important point around activities, any data that syncs into the Outlook client, so that's contacts and activities primarily, if you're migrating from on-prem to online and you're going to reconfigure your Outlook clients and use that same type of experience, you'll want to make sure that you maintain the record IDs. For those of you that maybe aren't, you know, maybe new to CRM or you're on-prem and don't know what that is, we can talk after, but basically you want to maintain your contact IDs and your activity IDs when you migrate your data. That way the Outlook client can identify those things correctly and not duplicate them and reconnect everything up without too much pain.
Right. All right, and then the other thing is the app for Outlook. So who here is using the CRM app for Outlook today? Anybody? One hand?
Who's heard of it?
Everybody else? Okay.
Okay, a little bit.
Right, so the CRM app for Outlook, when it first came out, was only available for online. Now you can use it with on-premise as well to be able to get it set up. But this is an alternative for the Outlook client for some of the activities. Right? It doesn't do everything, but if you just needed to track the email and see some information about related records and have it work cross-platform, right? That was a big holdup because when are you guys going to have an Outlook client for Mac? Right? I'm not on the product team, but I'm telling you it's probably not coming. This like app for Outlook works across platform, right? I don't think we're going to continue to do something with the old COM add-in. Right, and that's there, you can use it. It gives you a bunch more functionality, certainly, right? You have people that want to be able to, well, track contacts and appointments and that kind of stuff. We're looking to make investments on that. You hear, product suggestions, and we've seen stuff like that, commonly being requested. So I would expect for us to continue to put that in there to work. And it works on Outlook Web Access. It works, on your mobile devices. So you have the ability to do that. So look at, before you just blind, upgrade and reconfigure all 1,000 Outlook clients they have out there, look at which ones actually need it. So and for those of you who are administrators and troubleshooting the Outlook client, you guys are, yes, if we can get rid of some of those Outlook clients, nobody likes to troubleshoot the CRM Outlook client. And everybody would agree with that. All right.
Yep. All right. So reporting, another, I'm sensing that I'm getting a lot of topics with a lot of depth all of a sudden. Maybe I didn't pick my topics right. Integration, data migration, now reporting. So reporting, it's one of those areas when coming from on-prem, reports were, I'm not going to say easy, because it was a little bit different. You had these filtered views. The perf wasn't always optimal because you're filtering on all these record level security settings. But you just write some SQL and ship a report. With online and it being a SaaS service, we don't have access to the database. We don't give access to customers, and it isn't broadly accessible. We do have Fetch XML. So just like on-prem has Fetch XML starting in CRM 2011 and going forward, we continue to have Fetch XML for online. So first tip is if you're on-prem and you're starting to look at reports or think about reports, start simplifying. I can't think of a single example where a customer went from on-prem to online and didn't shed a significant number of reports. For many reasons, but one of the primary reasons is reports tend to get created, published, used for a while, and then not used. And then they sit there, and who's ever gone out within their company, found a report, and then called somebody and said, hey, I need to log a ticket because this report should be deleted. I don't use it anymore. Nobody does that. So first thing is try to get rid of some of those things. The second thing is just because you're on-prem doesn't mean you can't write Fetch XML reports and start building that skill set and start looking at what's possible. Because there are a lot of things that are possible using Fetch XML reports. They are definitely different than SQL reports. These are things like using multiple data sources to stitch the sources together in the report, a couple of workarounds to kind of manipulate the data within the report. There's also some limitations in terms of how many records you can pull back. So these are all good things to try now when you're on-prem as you're moving forward and start scoping out what's possible. The other thing is there's been continued additional investments into Power BI, and this isn't stopping. We're going to continue doing that as a company. Power BI is a great self-service BI tool and enterprise-wide BI tool. CRM scenarios have primarily focused on self-service BI for the user, but again, we're continuing to invest here over time. So look at Power BI, because I do think Power BI allows a lot of users, regardless of their age and their job focus and their, you know, what they're good at, it makes it really simple to go in and interact with data live. So start looking at Power BI and how you can use it, because I think that alone could take a chunk of 15 or 20 common reports and turn them into one Power BI dashboard. Little anecdote at Microsoft, a lot of our reporting that went into, you know, screenshots in a PowerPoint deck or a report on the screen, we now sit in meetings and we see Power BI decks that are presented on the screen, and someone goes, yeah, but let's drill into the profitability, and we drill in, and you can. So it's not just slideware, it's not just marketing. I mean, we use it all the time for that on a lot of data. CRM supports it as well. And then the final thing is, that doesn't work for me. Let's say you're in that category. There are ISV options as well. So one of those options is you can take your data, use a web job, refresh a SQL database. You can also use something like Scribe Online, which can allow you to schedule jobs and data sources and import that into an on-prem or cloud-hosted database. So for example, what you could do is say, I'm going to build something that retrieves all changed records and does an initial sync. I'm going to run it every so often and configure it, and it's going to show up in a cloud-hosted database. Totally something you can do today, and I think you'll see more features coming in this regard in the future as well.
Right. Two other things on the reporting to share. Power BI dashboards, you can actually embed them into the dashboards in CRM Online now. So if you've created that in Power BI with CRM Online, you can go in the settings, and you can enable that option. You can actually display a Power BI. So not only all of our .NET chart controls, the things that we've got in the app, but now Power BI stuff in CRM dashboards very easily. And then the other thing is for Fetch XML, for those of you who don't do Fetch XML or you haven't really written that, if you can write an advanced find query, right, you can get your Fetch XML. There's a button right on top. Just download Fetch XML, and then that's what you need for your report, for your data source.
Yeah, and I just thought of another thing too, since mobility is next, but a lot of people say, what's the reporting solution on the iPhone? Or what's the reporting solution on the iPad or my Android tablet or whatever? That's another area where Power BI shines, because now you can make Power BI available and you can log in through the app. So that is something I've not seen a ton of customers use that, but when they discover it and they have a need for it, it works quite nicely. Because again, if you're using the connector built in to Power BI, you get the record level filtering. Someone can have a dashboard configured for them, simply log in on their phone, and that dashboard's right there on their phone. So instead of telling your executive to log in and go download it or go look at it on the web, you can simply set it up, have the dashboard published to that person, and they can get it on their phone.
Right. Other things are mobility. So your mobile devices, same type of thing with those. If those are configured for your IFD on-premise deployment, you're going to have to reconfigure those to online. If you're depending on which devices you're using, we've got apps for all those now, right? So for Windows phones, Android phones, iPhones, all the different, whether phones, tablets, we've got the apps for those that you can use and configure. The other thing that we run into is it's the same form now when you're using CRM Online starting with 2016 for the web, for the tablet, and for the phone. So it's nice that it's that way, but also for you guys as administrators and customizers, you'll run into some things too that you'll have to code around and kind of look at to get it to display right, because it's kind of a what you see is what you get, but you do have some control and configuration over that. And the link is on our blog article that explains how that works out of the box, and then also how to start to control some of that and change it.
And there is now, in the later versions or most recent versions of the product, you can actually launch a preview in the web UI, so you don't need to download it on your device as you're customizing and wait for it to sync. You can just say preview as mobile. There's a little drop down when you're doing form design, so you can get a rough idea of what it should look like and get some real-time feedback instead of waiting.
Right. And your custom JavaScript is going to work as expected on there. Mm-hmm. And also on the tablet devices, you can have web resources and iframes support to be able to have that. That was a preview feature before. Now that's available. All right. The next topic is CRM updates. So this is something, if you're on-premise, you were used to deploying update rollups. You'd go to the download site when they're available. If you haven't already, if you go to CRM in the field, in the upper right-hand corner, Greg Nichols on our team there's a blog article that he just kind of updates every time. It's got a link to all the updates for every version of CRM, to the KB and the download article. Release date, everything is out there. So it's nice to see the version. If you look at your help about, nobody remembers exactly what the version numbers are. But if you go to Greg's blog article there, you can go see that, you know, version 123.729 is this. And you can see all that information on there. In CRM Online, the way it works, they're customer-driven updates. And the customer-driven updates are going to be like taking you from CRM 2016 to 2016 update one. And those are ones that you schedule. So you as a system administrator go into the administration portal in Office 365, the CRM admin portal, and there's a scheduler. And you just schedule your update and say, I want it to happen on October 1st. And that will automatically go through and happen for you at that scheduled time. If it doesn't, you have a secondary time picked. If it, you know, for whatever reason yours fails or it takes too long in the maintenance window because everybody, there's more people that signed up at that time, it'll just slip to the next date. And so that stuff is just handled for you through there. So you can go and schedule your lower level environments, the sandboxes that we'll talk about next. Schedule those ahead of time so you can, just like you would if you're on-premise, right? You would upgrade your dev environment first, then you'd move to your QA and staging and things like that before you actually did your production upgrade. And then there's weekly service updates. So instead of having to wait for the next update roll up like you did with on-premise, it might be 2 months before you get an update or 3 months, 4 months, depending on that time window of, and what we're all needed to include in that update. With online, we can service it much faster. So there's actually weekly service updates that are being put in place, some of them behind the scenes stuff that doesn't impact you at all, where you're never gonna see it or you're not even really gonna realize it is our stuff. But then also ones where there are things that you know, maybe support cases that you put in to request fixes or just other things. So those are the notifications that you'll get. So as a CRM administrator, you'll get those notifications, and there's a link to the KB article that explains here are the four fixes that were included, or seven, however many there were for that weekly update. All right, and the sandboxes versus the production organizations. So those are the two different types of organizations you have in CRM Online. Production is, of course, your production instance. That's the one that you're gonna be using with all your production data. It's gonna have some safeguards, I guess, so that you can't do certain things. We don't allow you to reset your production org, right, or to delete your production org. There's things there you would have to be, you know, we make you jump through some hoops to do that, and that's intentional. Where the sandbox organizations, you can reset those at any time. You can delete your sandbox if you for whatever reason you wanted to. You can go through and do those things. You can also put it in admin mode. So you can take and you can put one of those in admin mode, and you could, you know, publish customizations. You could put a message out there saying, hey, we're deploying the October release, and we're going to be down until 10 o'clock at PM, and then we'll be back available. Whatever you want to do, you can put that in there. One other tip on there is you can actually take your production instance and convert it to a sandbox instance, and then put it in admin mode with that message on there. Because some people say, well, why don't you have messages for production instances? Well, if you convert your production to a sandbox instance, and it sounds scary if you've never done this before. It was scary the first time that I did this with my customer, you know, 600 gig database. How long is this gonna take? Just a one to a zero. It happens right away. It's very easy. You flip it to a sandbox, you deploy your customizations when it's in admin mode, everything that you need. When you're done, take it out of admin mode, convert it back to a production instance.
The difference we look at as a group that hosts this and supports it is, the difference between production org and a sandbox org is really one digit. And then what it means to you is there's a cost difference, and then there's safeguards. So if you want it cheaper and less safety, then it's a sandbox. If you want it a little bit more expensive and the safeguards are in place, then it's a prod instance. And really now giving you the ability to flip that bit back and forth now says, I'm willingly removing these safeguards, and then there's plenty of those, are you sure, are you sure, are you sure, things. But that allows you to go in and do things like turn it into admin mode, or you know, disable async operations at one point if you need to do that. So
right. The other, Ray?
Can you do on-demand upgrades with a sandbox?
It's not on demand.
Yep, no on demand upgrades yet.
Yeah, it's on the roadmap. We get the request.
I'm sorry, backups.
Yes, that's my next topic. One last thing on sandbox versus production. The other thing I'll commonly hear is that it's slow in my sandbox org, right? We're trying to work on it. I'm sure it'll be faster when we get to production. That's not true, right? If it's slow, we treat all orgs exactly the same. They're on the same hardware, so don't fall for that. If you're like, if it's slow on sandbox, that it's going to be better hardware when it goes to production. It's the same hardware. You're potentially on the same scale group behind the scenes for what's there. So you need to figure out why is it slow in the sandbox before you deploy to production. And then go ahead.
I was just going to say, same with trials too. So don't have an expectation. There is more density in the trials, and I think everybody understands that. If you spin up a trial, they're usually in a little bit more of a dense environment. But the infrastructure, the hardware, the way that thing was built is the same thing if there was one customer on it as if there's, you know, hundreds or thousands of customers on it. So you shouldn't expect, if you're in a position and you're thinking, well, it's a trial org, so it's probably going to be slow, same thing applies. And it's worth getting checked out, because the worst case scenario Well, the best case scenario, maybe it's slow in a trial, you call up and you find out, yeah, you're in a really dense scale group, and so what we're gonna do is we can move you around, or maybe you've found something and now you're gonna find it when you're trialing it and demoing it, and not necessarily when you're doing something as a release.
The only thing I'll add to that is when you get your trial org, when you're filling it out and you say what country you're in, that's the region that your trial gets deployed in.
Yes.
So I've had that before where they've got a consultant and they're over in India and they set up the trial and they're like, man, this trial thing is really, it's really slow. Well, you're in the US and you're accessing an org over in the India data center. So make sure when you do the trial org, you actually select the whatever country you want it to be deployed in. But it's also a neat trick if you're thinking about going multi-geo and you wanted to say, what would it be like? You could sign up for a trial. You know, choose the India as a country, and it'll deploy an instance there, and you can see what the latency is back and forth. All right, and then the next one, the backup and restore, to the question we just got, that's something we just added. So we just released that probably about 2 months ago, maybe, and it's only for CRM 2016 Update 1. So you may be wondering, like, I read the article on TechNet, it's out there, and I saw this feature, but when I go into the CRM admin portal, I don't see the backup and restore, or I see it, but none of my orgs are available. You're only going to see, especially if you've got some that are on Update 1 and others that aren't, that's why. Only the ones that are on 2016 Update 1 currently support that. But it'll be, as we go forward, then, you know, all newer versions beyond that will continue to support that backup and restore. And what that gives you, it is, it's an on-demand backup. So if you're doing a data migration, you want to get a backup, you can instead of having to call the Microsoft support team and say, hey, can you guys back up my organization? And, you know, it's my customer tells me it's anywhere from 2 to 4 hours. Right, by the time support calls you back and you get that and you get the backup and they go through, now you can do it on demand. And so you can, we'll show a demo of this after a little bit and you'll be able to do that. The backups themselves are kept there for 3 days and they don't count against your storage quota. So you can put them out there and you can label them whatever you want when you create those backups. And you can restore them on demand as well. So if your data migration goes bad, you can restore that back.
And you can do it for either a sandbox or a cloud.
You can back up a sandbox or a prod org. You can only restore a backup on top of a sandbox org. So you can't wipe out a prod org unless you first downgrade the license through the portal.
Same trick applies, right? Yep. You could convert your production to sandbox if you needed to do that.
And we're going to demo the admin center after we're done with our 15 tips, so we can take a few more questions then, too.
Yep. Next two are yours.
Org Insights is you, though.
Okay, I'll take. So organizational insights. This is a preview feature that's in 2016 Update 1. So how many people here are using any preview features today? Couple? Yeah. Seen some of it? So the preview features are out there. If you go into the system settings, it's the last tab when you go into the settings administration. You can see it there. And you can enable these. Organizational insights is a new one. This is an exciting one. It's okay. It's got some stuff in there. It's got the ability to see like active users and kind of what they're doing and total page requests and things like that. We've got a lot more coming for this. So even with the fall release, there'll be more updates. It gives much more information. And this is a great place for your insights. So it's providing ideas on our idea website for product suggestions as ways that we can enhance this. But this is really nice. It's something that all my customers that move from on-premise to online were missing. They were like, I don't get to see that. I'm not able to do it. Organizational Insights is going to help you with that. The preview feature, what it means, though, is that it's technically not supported. It's there, it works, but if something's broke, we're not going to be like creating a hot fix for it. It'll be updated in the next one. So for all those preview features, there's a little disclaimer you have to read and agree to. You know, keep that in mind for any of those preview features.
And on that front too, with the preview feature, so one thing to think about there is Organization Insights is one of those great things where it's implemented one way in a dashboard today. It might be implemented in that way in the future, or it might be something where it has its own admin center experience, or we move it around. But the idea is we want to get the outcome out there so that people can see it and really work with it. So you might get a slightly different UI experience. You'll definitely get more depth in the data. But today it's implemented just as a straight dashboard that might, something like that might change in the future. So just be ready for that that's what that whole not supported partially means, as well as we might move it around or make some tweaks to it or take things away if people don't like it or it's not displaying accurate info. And it's also an opportunity for us to make sure our stats are right too. So generally speaking, they're going to be right. We're not going to publish something that's wrong, but we can be tweaking things and making sure we're counting things correctly. This is a phase for us to get it right too, and you guys to use it. The next thing I want to talk about, and this is really, really important from a dev standpoint, and I'm not just saying that, without some substance, Web API and OAuth support, primarily OAuth support, is the number one thing that people need to focus on today. So today we have client-side libraries. We call them client libraries, but they're .NET client libraries. So you go download these libraries off of NuGet. If you use the PFE core, they come along with it. These client-side libraries starting in 8.0 and higher, and now we are up to 8.1 dot something that's available. These are using OAuth and all the newest and best authentication methods. And what this means is, as we start to change things in online, we have some old authentication methods that are still out there and being used. As those are deprecated, or in one case, it's already deprecated and it's going away, you need to be on those newer libraries. Functionally, as long as that library is working for you, if you have a .NET project and it's compiling and it's executing, updating that library will not force you to change your code and how you're structuring things, but it will use the new auth flows, which is really important. So again, if you're not on 8.0 or higher, you can update to 8.0. The other interesting thing is the 8.1 and 8.0 libraries, and all the libraries are, as of right now, backwards compatible all the way to 5.0. So you can take the 8.1 libraries and actually connect to CRM 2011 with them if you want. Of course, the newer messages don't work, but it will functionally work. So people say, well, I'm on an earlier version of CRM. Should I use the 8.1 or the 8.0 libraries? The way we look at our client libraries is we're always moving forward. So you'll see a lot of fixes go to all of them, but really all the newest stuff is going to go in the newest library. And Matt Barber, who runs that program, is really strict about having proper backwards compatibility. So you should be able to go as far forward as you want. The next thing is, and this one's always a little sticky, so I'm sure we'll get a little bit of questions on this maybe, is the deprecation of the 2011 endpoint. And when this announcement went out, you know, you could hear some panic ensue. So from a communication standpoint, I think it's really good to be clear. The 2011 endpoint is not going away in the fall. The 2011 endpoint is not going away in the release after that. It will go away after that. I don't know if it'll be the release directly after the next one or if it'll be two more ahead in the future. But if you were familiar with the 2007 endpoint, that just went away in 2013. So it took a while for it to essentially phase out. Same thing's gonna happen. So what I hope I'm not doing is giving everybody an excuse to say, all right, we'll pick it up in a year or two. Think about this. So if you're on the .NET client libraries, I have good news for you. We're gonna do that for you. So I've talked to Matt. The idea is, as of today, we're gonna slowly start migrating over all those messages in the client library to start using Web API when and where appropriate, and we'll start doing that over time. Another reason to stay current. So you don't need to go write your own HTTP client library today. So rest easy. Now, you're on Java, you're on maybe .NET, and you've rolled your own authentication. You're using maybe LiveID or ACS authentication. There's some work to do. If you're .NET and you've done that, start using the SDK. If you're Java and you've done that, I've got really good news. Vittorio, the guy with the really long hair who does all of our identity at Microsoft, has this library that does all the authentication for you. It's called ADOL. We take a little ADOL, we marry it up with their Java code, and you're authenticated to CRM Online using OAuth. So it's maybe a little bit harder than that, but not really. It's pretty easy to use. Go watch his sessions, and he makes it really simple. So. Yes. So the question was, did we cover the upgrade? And I think you were walking in right when I was saying that. You want to get current. So more updates will come, but if you're using the client-side SDK, again, update early and often.
All right, and then the last one, CRM administrators. So one of the things that I'll hear, and I kind of get pushback from on-premise CRM administrators, is that if we move to online, I'm going to get fired. I'm going to lose my job. I'm not going to have anything to do. I can rest assured that's not the case, right? So there is a lot of administration that has to happen with online too. You're still going to have to manage the organization. You're still going to have to help troubleshoot. You're still going to have to help work with the customizations and the solutions. There's integrations. The list goes on of different things. So we don't be afraid by moving to online. It's just a different set of tools you're going to use. You're not going to be in Deployment Manager anymore. You're going to be in the Office 365 Admin Center managing your organizations. It's really the if that's what you're doing, it's just you're just logging into a different website to do the management a little bit different. And I can tell you that you know, I, for the first 6 years I worked with on-premise enterprise customers, I didn't do much with online. The last couple years, all my customers now have migrated to online, and that's all I do. It's tough to go back to on-premise. Like, oh man, I have to install something. Got to click through and do, I just want to click a button and it just provisions for me. And so it makes your life a lot easier with online, and we're going to show some of that in just a minute. But it's just a different, like I said, just different ways to go about it. Your CRM administrators, when you're looking at the ones that are in there, you're also going to see others that show up. You know, who are these guys? I've heard of that guy. He's on the Exchange team. And I have no idea who these seven people are. Those are global admins. So your global Office 365 admins automatically sync over into CRM as users. They're going to be listed as administrative Cal users. They don't actually consume a license, but they're the ones that are there. They could add users, and they could add business units or do different things that, you know, just to manage CRM. But those are the ones that are going to be there. You do need to know some of the global admins today, because there's two things that in CRM Online that still require a global admin, and one is to provision a new instance. So if you bought another, you know, say we want two more sandbox instances, you work with your LAR and you purchase them, and then they'll show up, and you have to work with your Office 365 global admin. Then they'll go and just tell them, I want this to be, you know, called this, and I want this URL, and they just have to click through. It literally takes 5 minutes max, and they'll put the new org. The other one is approving email addresses. So if you're using the server-side sync and you need to synchronize your mailbox from Exchange down to CRM, a global admin has to approve it. Just a CRM administrator can't do it. It has to be a global admin. So keep that in mind with when you're working through that. And then the other thing I'll say, with CRM Online, it's part of the service that you get is you do get unlimited free reactive support. So if you run into something, break, fix, and you need to get somebody to help out, you can engage the CRM support team. We've got, I don't even know how many there is now. There's hundreds of them across the world. So depending on what region you're in and where you go to, you can engage the CRM support team. When you're engaging the support team, always include what URL you have, right? Don't just say, my CRM Online has a problem. Try to include what URL, because you guys will have multiple URLs usually. But if you put that, then we can look up all the details behind the scenes of your org and the version number and where you're located and updates and all that kind of stuff is available. So just include that when you're submitting the cases, but you do have the ability to engage the CRM support team. And the last thing I'll say before we jump into the demo, one of the things as a CRM administrator I did all the time with on-premise was took platform traces. I'd have to turn on platform tracing and have them reproduce the issue, and then I'd have to try to remember to turn off platform tracing so I don't fill up my disk drive. But now, with online, we've got that exception level platform tracing on all the time. So it's always running there. So the other thing is, when you get if you have an error message and you're gonna contact support, click that download details button, because it's got a timestamp in there. And when you have that in the URL, then the support engineer can go back in the platform trace and look exactly what happened, other exceptions that are around there, and get more details. So just include that right away, and it'll save you guys a lot of back and forth on those cases.
And one thing that I think I can say safely without getting in trouble as far as our next release, because I know this for a fact, is we're going to have activity IDs in your error messages. So start thinking as administrators, when certain things happen in the UI, when that becomes available coming up this fall, start thinking about talking to the user. Hey, if you see that really long, gnarly looking GUID, copy that. You know, take a screenshot if you want to, but copy that and send it to us, because the benefit that we're going to have, whether we're your PFE or you're contacting support, you can actually say, here's the, I can't remember exactly what to call it, but basically here's the activity ID or the ID of my problem. And then that allows us to go back and look at the actual call stack of the error. So today we have all the call stacks, and we can say, here's when it happened. Yep, we can connect the dots. When we have that GUID, we can actually say, show me all of the information related to what happened here. And I know beyond the shadow of any doubt as a support person that that is exactly what happened to your user. So that is going to be even more important than ever, and something I know we've been lobbying for a long time. And so some folks made a lot of changes this fall, and we're going to make it happen at this point. So start thinking about that as well. So more information, the better, but that should be really easy for users to capture, hopefully. With that, we are going to jump into a demo really quick here. So we talked a lot about the instance management. This is the Office 365 preview portal. If you haven't seen the preview, this is what the new version of the portal is going to look like, or looks like. And as an administrator of Office 365, I can just go to my admin centers, and I can click on CRM. When I click on CRM, I'm brought to this page that shows me all of my instances. So this is a test environment, a real test or a real instance tenant that we use as PFEs to play around with and create some different orgs and instances. And so you can see in here, we prefix these with our version numbers. Maybe a tip you want to employ yourself if you're going to have multiple versions, just keep up with it because you'll see.
It's a product suggestion as well, right? Yeah. Why isn't version a column in here?
Yeah.
For anybody listening.
No, that's really true. aka.ms/CRM ideas. Yeah. And then you'll see if I was not a global admin in this instance, my experience would be as I click through here, I might see these cool little buttons in some instances and not in others. And what controls that is the system administrator role. If I have the system administrator role, I'm going to see all these buttons. If I have a customizer role, I'm going to see some of the buttons. If I'm a global admin, I'm basically a system administrator. I'm going to see everything. And so you can see here, these are all sandbox instances. If I were to go to my North America production instance, you're going to see that I have the ability to go in and edit it. When I click edit, what that's going to do is go get my org details, my super top secret URL, test12345.crm.dynamics.com. But you're going to notice I really couldn't do anything, right? Those buttons didn't show up. So what I can do is downgrade my license or flip the category or classification of the instance to sandbox. So when I do this, it's literally going to say, are you sure this is what you want to do? Yes. And I'm going to go ahead and save it. So this is going to call back to our service, validate that everything's cool, flip the bit, and refresh it. And now I come out here, and it's now a sandbox instance. And I get all these great things. So I don't think I actually want to delete that one. But you could delete it if you wanted to. I'm not going to get into that. But I can go out here, and I can delete this one. And now I'm going to delete it. And just that easy, I can delete everything in that instance, and it can be gone. So that might be good, that might be bad, but that's why we don't assume that you should be able to delete production instances. That's why we make you jump through that hoop, because it is that easy, even though there's a couple of prompts. The other thing we talked about is backup and restore. Well, actually, updates first. You're going to notice your updates can be rescheduled in here. What ends up happening is when you create an instance or you copy an instance or you restore an instance from a backup or you initially upgrade, within roughly 24 hours, we advertise, quote unquote, advertise an upgrade to you, meaning you'll see an upgrade option in here for a release. This is where you go in and you give us your primary and secondary times of when you want to be updated. One important thing is, and this happens a lot, you have to click approve update. So even though you click schedule the times, if that approve update button is there, you should press approve update. If you don't press approve updates, we will not upgrade you. We will skip you and we'll try again. But if you don't actually approve, we won't upgrade you.
And we added that as a feature request, right? Because we had people that all of a sudden came in and, hey, our org got updated overnight, right? We didn't have that originally. So we've added that. But then the other thing I'll say is, our communication team does a really good job making it look very important. It says action required, important action. The global administrators get these notifications too. And I've had this a couple times where a global admin who knows nothing about CRM is like, hey, it says I should approve this update. And they just click approve.
Yeah, so keep an eye on these.
Yeah, so you kind of want to keep an eye on that and or communicate, right, to your other global admins who are getting these notifications that don't touch CRM. We got it, right? We're going to take care of that and make sure you handle it that way so there's no surprises.
Oh, question at the mic. Yeah, good. You want to?
Yeah, I'll take it. Good question. So the notifications themselves can be added, and you can, like, if you have a group that's, like he's saying, if you had a group that's an administrator and everybody was part of that distribution group, instead of adding individual emails, you can add in the notifications area, Sean's pulling it up here, you can add that distribution list in there so that everybody gets that email. So by default, CRM administrators will get that, but then also anybody that you add in here. So individually or distribution lists, as he was asking about.
All right, any other admin center questions? English or Japanese only, please. Yeah. I knew somebody's going to ask that.
Good question.
So the question is, what happens if I just have, you know, blatant disregard for updates and I'm not going to update at all? And that's actually what one of these orgs out here, that's what I did because I wanted to try it. I left it on 6.0. And eventually, a couple different things go into determining what's going on. If we have a relationship with the customer, we'll go look them up. We'll go find them. We'll make a lot of effort and attempts to contact that that person or whoever's responsible. But eventually, when there's been enough time and we actually need to sunset the hardware and move on to the next version, we will force an upgrade. So whether that's 6.0 to 6.1 or in some cases like 6.1 to 7.1. So it's not like, you know, we're 3 months behind and so we're going to auto upgrade you. But certainly if you don't go out here, your global admin or whoever's responsible for your Office 365 subscription will get a phone call with, you know, a message such as, hey, here's the deal. We really need you to do this. Can we talk to you, figure out what's going on here? Did you spin it up and forget about it? Or is there a reason you can't move? And it's not really about forcing as much as it is, we really kind of want to understand, why are you still on CRM 2013 and online? So best advice that I have is, if you have a reason, you know, whether it's technical or not, work with us in advance to help figure that out if you can. By and large though, I mean, as far as percentages go, a very, 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 very low number that this happens to, and a lot of times they're internal trials or they're internal instances like ours where there really isn't an admin, and so we can upgrade those. So.
And they,
I'll add to your response.
Sure.
That's all right. So the question is sort of about how long do you have? When we give an official response, we'll sort of tell you it's more or less about 2 years. All right, so if you keep pushing delay, we're just gonna nag you more and more and more.
So the question is how long do you have? Brandon is adding some more to that, but there. So we also do have the policy listed. So you guys, when you signed up, everybody read the end user license agreement, right? And yeah. In there it says you have to stay within 2 releases. And so that's why they do turn to mandatory. The comms will change. Instead of saying an update's available, it's saying a mandatory update is coming. And we technically do have the right to upgrade you, right? So that, but we like McNeil's saying, we work with you and make sure that kind of guys know that's going to happen, but this is part of the online service is staying current, so you do need to stay current as you go.
Let me add just one more thing to that. When that day comes and like you ignored them all, I mean, called all your admins and emailed numerous times and just repeatedly tried to contact you about this and it hasn't happened, we're going to force that upgrade, as both Sean said. There's no going back after that. Like,
right.
There's no scenario in which you call us.
Right. Yeah. So Brandon added that there is no going back to the previous version. If you waited and you didn't respond and we manually moved you to the next version, there is no call in on Monday and we're going back to 6.0 somehow. That's not going to happen. Other question?
So one of my clients recently asked me this question and I hadn't researched it yet and I'd never been asked it before. So if you change the URL, what is the impact of that? Does the Outlook plugin automatically pick that up if you signed up with CRM online? You know, obviously I know in code if you've not used the XRM call correctly or you're directly hard typing and hard coding the URL, that would affect that. But what are the impacts of just changing the URL here because the company might be doing a name change or something?
Right, so kind of two parts to it. The first part being when you change it, DNS has to get updated. So your old URL and the new one will work for 24 hours. Right, so both of them will work. That's the first part.
Up to
24 hours. But yeah. You do need to communicate that to your end users. I've had that happen before. Like, hey, the testers in India come back and like, hey, URL's not working. Oh yeah, we didn't send an email. Everybody in the office got the email, but in the other office, nobody didn't get it. So you have to communicate that. The Outlook client one itself on that, I think you're going to have to reconfigure.
Reconfigure, right. Push an updated URL to the registry, yeah. Is another option. But yeah, because that's the way it locates it. It doesn't use discovery to figure out which org it is based on ID. You would have to reconfigure it. I could be pleasantly surprised and wrong, but I have a feeling we're...
I haven't done it with the Outlook client. I've changed it, but I've never had it already configured and then decided we're going to change the URL. Because yeah. I mean, like the org ID is stored in the registry key and there is some stuff there. Like I said, it could be pleasantly surprised, but I would expect you may have to push a new config. Yeah. Yeah, good question. Okay.
Got it. So one of our co-presenters has chimed in.
Perfect.
That who's already there and actually tried it out, so we saved a little bit of time. It does break the Outlook client because the Outlook client can't find the endpoint anymore.
Perfect.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Org name, no problem, right? That first box.
Correct. Yeah, if you change, good question. Yeah, so if you change the name or the descriptor that you want to show up in the instance picker, that does not, that doesn't alter anything. That's just there for vanity purposes.
The friendly name.
Hey, just back on migration.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have a recipe as to which entities you should migrate first and kind of what the special sauce is, like when you have to put them in the first time as all active and then you have to deactivate the ones that aren't?
Good question. Yeah, so is there a recipe? There isn't necessarily a recipe. I will tell you that cleverly by accident or on purpose, I'm not really sure, but you'll notice the object IDs, right, or the object type codes of the entities. Account is one, contact two, lead four, system user eight. Basically, what you want to do in terms of data, though, is really start with account and contact where the data is rooted and move forward. Because what will happen is with things like activities, you could create the activities, but then you have to go back and relink them, for instance, with customer data. So really, there isn't necessarily a recipe. And one of the reasons is there's some, I guess you could say, counterintuitive things you can do during data migration, such as you can import massive or millions amounts of data in, or millions of rows of data in different entities that don't have a lot of links, and then go do the links later, and that turns out to be a lot faster in terms of process. So there really isn't a recipe other than starting with the most common entities and working out from there. Usually activity is the last, because activity is usually the, you know, activities and connections are the glue that kind of stick things together in the system. I don't know if you have anything to add on that front.
No, that's...
Yeah, no, good question.
Can I ask a question in Japanese again?
English would be preferred for the guests.
I can give you an answer in English. I don't know if it'll answer your question.
So let's say I take backup and adding 10 more users. And what happens if I restore the data?
Got it. So I take a backup of my instance. And you're a teammate of ours, right?
These are not softballs.
Yeah, no softballs. So I take a backup of my instance. I add 10 users, I then go back and I restore my instance, I flash back, like let's say it's a environment, I wanted to try out some things, and then I'm gonna go back to my gold standard and my base. Here's what will happen, is you'll restore it, that org will come back online. We have a sync engine in the background that connects Office 365 and its identities to the instance itself. That engine wakes up. I don't know necessarily the amount of time it would take, but within, let's just say within an hour or so, would synchronize those users. What you would not get, so the users would appear, they would be provisioned as you restored the instance, they would be added in, right? What you would not get is the roles for those users. So the users would show up, they wouldn't have any permissions. So if you had a provisioning job or a web job external to give roles, that thing would then have to wake up and go give them roles. But good question, as long as they meet the requirements as far as security group filtering and license, they would be automatically provisioned in the instance.
Do we support that scenario? Because it was not supported before, right?
I don't know that it wasn't not supported. Maybe in a couple edge cases, but yeah, the scenario of restoring is supported, so therefore we support it, and I guess if it doesn't work, open a support case because it should work.
Sure.
So.
Yeah, I didn't see, and then I have the TechNet article on the blog that has it, and I didn't remember seeing any disclaimers about scenarios that weren't supported with it. So
yeah, because the provisioning, the cloud sync provisioning process between these systems that are sitting just outside of Azure Active Directory with licensing, the way these things work is they diff out who's new, what's different. They'll look at what the last person or thing was put into the system. And so that'll wake up eventually within some minutes and say, oh, hey, there's 10 users that should be here that aren't. I'm going to go ahead and add them. So they will show up. It won't be instant. It's probably going to be within an hour or so, because even though your org is restored and online, it does take a while for all the systems to light up to recognize that, okay, this thing's online now. The other thing is, I believe when you restore an instance, does it go automatically into admin mode?
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, so if it's in admin mode, then it'll get ignored until you turn on admin mode. So.
This is in regards to moving the data migration from on-premise to online. And the goal is to preserve created, modified owners and such for users that are inactive. Now, handling inactive users and on-premise is a lot easier than online. My question is, are stub users the right way to preserve that ownership and data?
Yeah.
Even for custom entities.
Yes. So stub users, the original use case, so stub users, and for those who might not know, what a stub user is a user without a link back to a true identity. So, you know, SeanMCN2 at Microsoft.com could be created in our CRM instance by me, a system admin, but that user doesn't exist in our directory. And so therefore they're orphaned and they're in a disabled state with a salesperson role and nothing else. And now they can be assigned, you know, records in the system. And so stub user's original use case was people are gonna go to online, they're gonna have to migrate. We need this to be there. So yes, that addresses your use case and it's supported and that's the reason for that.
It's really like the users that you deleted from Active Directory that still exist in CRM because you can't delete users from CRM.
Right?
That's what you're, that's the equivalent of that as you go to online migrating your data.
So how do you create a stub user?
Through the API. Yep. Good question. So there's two, well, there's actually two ways to create it. You can export system users to XML, or sorry, to Excel and add a user and import it through tools import. It works. Don't necessarily recommend it. I mean, I would like a little bit more control myself. You can't create a stub user through the UI, but you can create one through the API. So you can use XRM data PowerShell. So there's an XRM PowerShell add-on, and you can create a user that way, or you can just write a simple .NET app to create a user. The important thing is the username. You want to try and preserve the username, and that username has to be unique. So if you have a company where they reuse usernames, you might have to do some finesse with how that works. Although it, at the end of the day, it's really not going to be that much different than what you already deal with on-prem, because you would have that duplicate issue there too. So the other question was around created, modified on. Now there's, in 2011, we added a field called created on overridden. And created on overridden works really nice in our views, like within SQL. We actually coalesce the data together and we say as long as created on overridden is not null, we take that first. That's what the user sees in the UI, and actually that's what the whole service sees, like all of CRM. So you really do have complete control over created on. You can change that as an admin or when you're importing data. Modified on you cannot change, although there is, I believe, a plugin step where you can override the modified on date, stage 20? Or is it in the post, 40? Huh? Okay, never mind. So, yeah.
Yeah.
No, the modified on is a little bit, that can be argued either way in that technically it was modified on this day. But yes, for data migration and historical data, I'm more in the camp that everybody in this room should go out to aka.ms/CRMideas and vote up a topic that says we should be able to override the modified on date. Part of the thing is there's some compliance concerns with the modified on versus created on. And so that's where we probably could use our other feature and fall back and say auditing covers that gap, but that's not mine to debate as much.
Okay, so just back to the original question, if migrating custom entities with a stub user owner doesn't work, it's time for a support ticket?
Oh, I know, okay, I see where you're coming, yeah. So I have a stub user and I go to create an entity as that stub user and it says they don't have permission, right? Yeah. The issue is that a stub user automatically gets a salesperson role. And so if you add permissions to the entity in the salesperson role, they magically can create and own those records.
You just solved a very big problem for me. Thank you very much.
Great. Please email my manager.
Yeah.
Oh. Good impact.
Fill out the survey.
Yeah. Fill out the survey.
Start with that. Did everybody understand that, though? Why? Okay.
Is there documentation on stub users?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, there is. There's documentation on stub users. There's I don't remember the article number or title per se, but it's an article about if you search stub user, CRM stub user, API, and maybe a couple other keywords, it'll pop up. It's a TechNet article, and there's actually a little matrix in there, and one of the things it says in there, and I believe it still says it in there, it's somewhat buried in the text. It says that they'll be given the salesperson role. What it does not say is you can't change that role today. So between CRM 2011 when it was online and CRM 8.1 today, there isn't a way to change those roles. That might change in the future, but right now you have to use the out-of-the-box salesperson role.
But you can add security permissions to it?
You can add permissions to the role You just can't change the stub user's role.
I have a follow-up on that. Sorry. Same topic.
Mm-hmm.
I know you have to have certain license flags set to create a stub user. For example, is licensed equals false, right?
Yep.
Let's say I create a stub user. You can't delete it. What if I change that user to a licensed user to be able to use CR? And you can't change this license property either.
Yeah, so I knew this question was going to come up. I could feel it coming. I kind of thought we'd get away clean. No. So the question is, I create a user, brkelly@microsoft.com, and he used to be here, and he's a stub user, and then we hire this, let's just call him Brandon, we hire Brandon back, and brkelly@microsoft.com is now a valid user. What happens in the system today is, during the user sync, it wakes up and it says, hey, by the way, is anybody named brkelly@microsoft.com in your system? If it's a stub user, it will take that user and convert them to a fully licensed user. I do not, to be completely honest, and this is recorded, so whatever, but I don't think that's documented, quite honestly. I mean, we've talked about doc bugs and trying to get that updated. What basically happened is when we switched provisioning agents from our old setup to our new one, this became a feature sort of by accident, in a good way because it solves a problem. But if you have a user that is a stub user and you add that user with the same UPN in Office 365, it essentially activates them, licenses them, and it wakes up. And you can start using that user.
Thank you.
Yep.
Hi. What are some of the things to have into account when migrating from premise with custom plugins and custom workflows?
Just things to keep in mind, or gotchas, or both?
Yeah, both.
Both. Okay, so the first thing is, anybody new to online might not know, but we have a different execution policy for online. And if you've ever registered a plugin on-prem, there's basically not isolated and isolated, or sandbox. And not to be confused with sandbox organizations, by the way. When you run a plugin in online, we're executing that for you. And anybody security focused is gonna cringe because we're taking code that you wrote and you're saying, hey, trust me, here you go. And we're executing it, right? So we have a lot of policies around that, like we run these in very isolated environments, and we have certain policies around it to whitelist or blacklist certain functionality. One of those things is like reflection. If you want to do reflection, you can't do reflection in an online plugin. So a lot of customers will say, how do I know if my plugin is going to work in Sandbox? One thing you can do on-prem is you just flip the isolation level to Sandbox, and you'll find out pretty quick because it will either work or it won't work. But some things to keep in mind there are reflection, if you're doing any reflection, if you're writing, accessing, or even trying to address any local resources, file system, registry, event log, none of that will work, guaranteed. What you should also be doing if you're on-prem, depending on what version you are, and going back all the way to CRM5, there was an eye tracing service where you could write to tracing, but you couldn't see it unless you had an exception. Limited use. I mean, it helped if there was an exception, but if you were logging out, like, hey, this is how long this operation took, you couldn't access that data. In CRM 8.1 or 8.0? Yeah, so in 8.0 for on-prem and online, we now have plugin tracing logs. So anything you log has the potential of being logged in your instance. So to step back, you put eye tracing in your plugin that says, hello world, and then what time it is, or the latency or stopwatch of how long something took to execute, it doesn't show up automatically, but if you turn on tracing of all plugin events, you see how long it took to execute, how long the constructor took to be created, the execution time, you get the GUID of the correlation and request ID so you can contact us for support, and you get all your trace messages inside of there. So use tracing service, and it gets all compiled. Like, what'll happen is, instead of you writing back individual messages to CRM, like some people have logging entities, iTracing, when you're using that and it's executing on the sandbox service, we collect all those messages, you know, basically concatenate all the strings together, and we write it once. So it is a lot more efficient. And as far as logging goes, there is an impact to logging. It's not gonna, you know, so far, from what I've seen, it will not take down your system. And in fact, most of the time, even when we're integrating millions of records are doing high throughput integration work or migration work, I don't see a lot of perf degradation or, you know, any overhead in terms of that tracing, so don't be scared of it.
A couple things to add to that.
Mm-hmm.
One, the execution timeout, 120 seconds. I'm going to definitely let people know about that. For
yep.
Plugins, no TCP connections, also for Sandbox plugins. And then Org Insights, we can touch on that.
We touched on Org Insights. Yeah, the big one there is timeout. You do have a timeout in Sandbox. If you have plugins that you're executing, especially synchronous plugins and on-prem, and it takes 4 minutes for it to do something, it's not going to work in online. And I've seen it before. So in most of the use cases around it are, hey, we want the user knows that it's going to take 4 minutes. That's the wrong way to do that. There are better ways to do it. Using even workflows to do things like go wait, and if you're going to time out, go reinsert yourself back as a execution record, that stuff. It's kludgy and it's hard to do and to get right, and for a reason, it's not the right place to do it. Especially in online, we've got these awesome facilities like Azure Web Jobs. We've got a whole bunch of new stuff in the fall coming in terms of authentication that makes things easier to talk. Start looking at those complementary services, satellite services that you can build to augment that. So that's not comprehensive, but that's a few things off the top of my head, yeah.
Right. I pulled up the tracing where you can enable that then too in the system settings.
Another question? Yeah.
Where can you
see the trace?
I believe
there's
under
yep.
admin or something, but
right here.
Okay.
There might even be nope. Yep.
I haven't.
Yes. So the other thing to remember about plugin traces is people say but billions of records will build up here. We have a job, a CRM scheduled delete job that sits and trickles in the background. So every 24 hours, it'll wake up and delete anything older than 24 hours at that point in time. There's two parts to that. The first is this isn't going to build up. Like, there were trace messages out here a week ago. They're not there anymore because they got cleaned up. So on the upside, this isn't going to pile up and fall behind and become a massive storage cost or anything like that. The flip side of that is if you have something out here and you think, oh, super interesting, I'm going to look at this on Monday, it won't be there on Monday. So you'll want to take that and either export it to Excel, or you can modify the recurrence of that delete, but I would just go collect the data you need, get it out of there. It's really there for more point in time or same day operations.
You can see the sandbox too. The animated GIFs work in the themes.
Yes.
So. All right.
So in terms of CRM online admins, besides the global admins, is there, in terms of license,
Nope. Not global admins.
Well, no. So besides global admins, if it's a CRM administrator, you then have to assign them a CRM license, right?
Yep.
But they can also be in admin mode. So
and
there's
not,
doesn't use a CAL. No, it doesn't use a license.
Okay.
Yep. If they don't need to create data and edit data, you can just have them in admin mode instead of the read write, and then they don't consume a CAL. And there's no limit. You can have as many as you want. Yep.
One last question. Is Microsoft working on a service for on-prem to online migration?
There is a session about that.
Friday.
Thank you. Friday.
Yep.
Adi Varma. Yeah, and we're working on a more elegant way to accomplish that. Yeah.
Is that lifecycle services? LCS?
I believe it will be exposed within LCS, yes.
Yep.
Adi would know for sure, but...
But it's different than the data loader tool that we talked about earlier.
Right.
Right? I mean, it's a different process. Yep.
There's some, I don't know, we should probably just have
to go to Adi. Yeah, go to the session. Yeah. Yep. We didn't want to steal his thunder, and it's his. Go ahead.
On that same note, I was going to ask if there was a way to preserve the audit history moving from on-premise to
online. That is a really good question, and no, you cannot. You cannot preserve the audit history when going from on-prem to online. I believe the intent with that is... On-prem, you can preserve that data store. Obviously, it's not quite as nice as if you could lift and move that audit history up, but you have a way to capture the audit history then. And if you started the migration or right after the migration, turning audit history on, from a compliance perspective, my understanding is that you can meet the compliance needs for most certifications that way and make sure that you have the audit data. If you use audit data for other interesting things, like giving users access to that audit data so they can see historical changes, that becomes a little bit more of a problem because you don't have that history. You would only have the point in time. And there is not a way to move that. Audit is a very special entity the way it was put together. So there isn't a really good way to move that data from one place to the other right now. Because it's what Brandon said is it's something we're definitely considering and we're looking at, because it is definitely something that comes up in almost every migration if people have significant audit history. So that can all be one spot.
Yep. It's on the roadmap. Excellent. All right.
One quick question.
Yep.
Is there going to be a better way to support reporting on auditing? Because right now you really can't do a whole lot. Is that on the roadmap as well? For...
So I won't answer that, but I'm going to tell you that there's, from a compliance perspective, it's not a technical challenge. It's
right. Yeah, so for anybody on the stream or the recording, Brandon added to that, which is really true, that the feature audit or the audit feature itself and the specification and the scenario is really around being able to meet customers' compliance needs and goals and standards. And so if we change that into a different sort of thing, then we might not be able to accomplish and still maintain the goal of making sure that it meets all the compliance concerns and needs. So audit was really strictly written and in some cases minimally written to meet the minimum needs or needs required at the time for things like SOX compliance and other compliance standards. So when we use it for other things, it can be really good, and we can use it for things like searching, and we can use it for things like restoring back to data points. They're really not around compliance. And so as far as that feature goes, it's really just there for compliance. So right now, that's probably not something. It doesn't mean that there can't be an idea or suggestion out there on top of it, but it is something that we need to make sure that it meets compliance first, and then we don't compromise that for anybody or ourselves. So.
All right. Hey, I know we've got a couple more questions, and we'll take these, but we are out of time. So come up with your questions. We'll answer the rest of them. Please fill out your evals. If you like this type of a session, you want to have more of this, please put it in there. This is our first Ignite, so we're still a pretty small presence at Ignite, the whole conference. We'd like to increase that. Need your help with the surveys, though. Otherwise, thanks for coming, and we'll stick around until you guys are done asking us questions, so no problem.
Yeah, thank you. So you want to take the two questions at the mic, or I don't know if they're going to extend the recording or not.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, just a quick stub user question again.
Yeah.
If you're going through the SDK, can you assign the owner of a record to a stub user?
Yes. Yep, so if you have a stub user, you can, in your importing records, you can assign the owner of a record when it's created as a stub user. Yep.
Yep.
And another question. Yep.
You mentioned a session on Friday about migrating data from on-prem to online.
Yep.
And you're going to be using something other than data import. Does that... address the user grid that changes when you provision users online?
Oh, good. Good question, because unless you use stub users, you can't. Yeah.
Data import doesn't handle that.
Yeah, so there are ways to do it with data import and mapping fields. It's a good question to ask Audie. The way the service should work now is it should treat the username or some field like an alternate key, so that you can key off of it. So I guess by the way it's put together, it should address that, but I definitely would ask him that question, and I'd let him answer that, but that is a scenario that was planned for.
Okay.
Just from the nature of the users are gonna be provisioned automatically, so we don't have control of the GUID, but we can find them by the username or something else. So,
thank you.
Yeah, good question. All right, cool. Thanks everybody, really appreciate it. Do you really have a question you wanna ask? Okay. Oh, okay. That sounds good. Whoops.